Friends through eternity, loyalty, honesty. We'll stay together through zombie takeout.
Welcome to episode 537 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout. Wait a minute, you are here, all over the place here.
As I sit here twitching.
Last week you said it was 336 when it was 436.
What did I say?
This week you just said it was 537 when it was 437.
I apologize, folks. It is 437. I was running a fever when we recorded last week.
That's true. And I didn't. I was gonna say something, but I decided not to because we were just getting off the ground. But then when you did it again this week, it was kind of like, wait a minute, is this a bit? I'm calling you out.
I was running a fever last time. Like 95% now. It's like that last 5% that takes forever to get out of your system. But and this also happened on the hearing. I made some mistakes. I'm dyslexic, and so when you're feeling unwell, that sort of thing, you know, comes out a lot. So that's why I've been messing that up. So yeah, once again, episode 437 of Zombie Takeout, the B-Movie and Cult Movie Show. I'm John.
Hello, I'm Scotto.
And without any further, well, before we get to this week's movie, a little further ado, from Bodo, some tweets this time instead of a voicemail. he said, at Zombie Takeout, why is it you're doing a night raid and there's one ninja dressed in white? I did a little research on the white ninja costumes or uniforms. They were used for snow.
Of course.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I wanted to check if there wasn't kind of any rank thing. It was just for snow camouflage. I pointed that out to Bodo and said, yeah, I didn't see any snow in that scene. And he replied, there was snow in the scene. It is Miami.
Well, I think in this case, it was a lot of confectioner sugar.
Probably. He then said, even though he used his own students, I think they were better actors than the ones in House 4. then, did they super the drums and cymbals together? Super cool. I'm not sure exactly. I think because it was a Simmons electronic kit that didn't move normally. And then finally, Miami Connection. If you get rid of the 50% music videos and training montages, you have a nice, oh, sorry, 50 minutes of music videos and training montages, you have a nice 45-minute short film. I'd give it 1.5 brains. And once again, without any further ado, on to this week's movie, which is from 1987, the infamous Miami Connection. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary. We forgot to do our sponsors beforehand. This is the first time we'll be hearing.
We're going to surprise each other with our sponsors.
Sponsored by Obvious Exposition. Singing, it really doesn't make it any better.
And also brought to you by Post-Brother Killing Makeouts. Oddly enough, a category missing from Pornhub.
Yeah. Huh.
All right. So, this one just pretty much writes itself, doesn't it? We have we start off with a Coke deal, an exchange that is being disrupted by ninjas in the middle of somewhere in Miami, which by the camera position, my expertise would say the Atlantic Ocean.
Somewhere there, yeah. Maybe the Gulf.
Stranger Things did the same thing, though. Someplace in Chicago, and it's like really on the lake.
It was filmed in Orlando, if I recall.
Well, you're right. But that's supposed to be in Miami because that's where the title comes from. Mm-hmm. They had the Miami connection at the very beginning. And, right. Of course, Miami is then never heard from or seen again because the ninjas steal all the cocaine. You first feel that the ninjas are good guys, but then you realize they just stole it, well, because, you know, they like cocaine and they like making money. Mm-hmm. And, it's Florida. Yeah. Right, so most of the action of this film does actually take place around Orlando, which, you know, the Kissimmee Cavaliers. And it's this synth rock band called Dragon Sound that we're introduced to. But it's all about really preaching the word of Taekwondo. And they you know, are incorporating into their act as much as humanly possible. And they seem to be very well liked for some reason in the Miami club or the Orlando clubs.
I think it was all set in Miami. It was just filmed in Orlando because that's where they were from.
No, because they talk about Central Florida University.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, once that opening scene was done, we were out of Miami and up in Orlando, all right. And they were moving the drugs up from Miami to Orlando.
Ah, okay, I missed that part of the dialogue.
And so, right, the head ninjas from Miami, and then the Ahmadinejad looking guy is like the guy from Orlando who, you know, buys the drugs from the head ninja. And and thank you for keeping me on track here for this awesome plot. This Taekwondo team somehow gets caught in the middle of this drug dealing team, mostly because the leader's sister is dating one of the band leaders, or Taekwondo leaders, band leader.
The Taekwondo guys are also a band.
And yes.
The bass player is dating the sister of the leader of, not the ninjas, but the gang who's moving the coke.
Right. And rather than trying to keep a low profile and just, whatever, you know, make you happy or whatever, he decides to be that guy that said, my sister shouldn't date anybody. And starts, if you look at it, they start the trouble and draw the attention to themselves that they did not need to do.
He's one of those guys who has that really creepy fixation on his little sister.
Yeah. Because they brought this attention to themselves, of course, it pretty much escalates into a war with most of them getting killed in one way or another, or at least pretty badly hurt. Mm-hmm. And they wind up having to call these ninjas in. We also are introduced to a few subplots. One of them, and it was really funny because after the Three House movies that we've seen, I really thought that this wasn't going to pay off when they start talking about this guy and looking for his father. After the last three movies that we've done, I assumed that was just going to go nowhere, but they actually had a payoff for it, which was shocking. I'm trying to remember the other subplot, but I...
the restaurant owner.
Oh, yes, that plot went nowhere. That's what I could write. They do the same movie trope of the immigrant uncle owning a restaurant, and of course it gets fucked with, but then he, like, fights them all off himself without them having to help him.
That's it.
We never see or hear from this guy again.
He was played by the co-director, so it was a cameo.
Oh, I see. And of course, he's a martial arts guy, he needed to get a little in.
He was Richard Park, who's done a ton of martial arts, directed a ton of martial arts movies.
And so they have, of course, the final confrontation with the ninjas, and hilarity ensues. Mm.
Now, the film came about after prolific martial arts director Richard Park, a.k.a. Park Woo-sang, saw YK Kim on the Korean talk show Meet at 11 p.m. in 1985, where Kim was promoting a book about Taekwondo. Park met Kim, convinced him to make a film. Park had conceptualized the story while watching the interview. So, martial arts director sees this interview with this guy who's a Taekwondo master, and, you know, decides, this guy's so passionate about it, his art, you know, I want to make a movie with him. Then he puts the martial artist in charge of the film as the director and co-writer. That's, I think, where it went wrong.
Was there really a writer to this? Because come on.
The story was co-written by Park and Kim. I think they brought another writer in later. I've been watching interviews and things about it all day. I forget his name. Joe Diamond, who played Jack, the drummer, talked about being roped in as like the production coordinator and then like one of the writers later. It was very much an independent production. It opened to poor box office scathing reviews and was long forgotten until 2009, when Jack Carlson, a programmer at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema in Austin, Texas, happened upon a seller on eBay who was selling a 35mm print. Carlson had never heard of the film, bought it for $35. In April 2010, he screened the film at the Draft House, became a wildly popular cult hit. More screenings took place to packed theaters. He called YK Kim about distributing it. Due to the film's failure being a painful experience for him, Kim originally said no, he thought it was a prank. Eventually, he relented and saw that his film had become a popular midnight movie 25 years later.
That's so amazing. Yeah. And the reason why I say, was there a writer? Because you could tell there are a lot of scenes where they clearly just had lines that they had to say. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when they said it, they weren't quite sure if it got caught on camera. So they repeat the line again. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that happening throughout this. And of course, it's hilarious because as a filmmaker, you recognize that a lot of just improvised scenes.
YK Kim and the band members are all very skilled martial artists. One of them is a very skilled musician, the lead guitarist, Angelo Giannotti, I think his name was.
Yeah.
Actually, does play guitar. He and Kathy Collier, the singer, wrote all of the music and demoed it. I think they probably recorded all of it. So
I refer to him as Mullet John Oates, by the way.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
But none of them have any business acting. Now, the opening is like a low-budget episode of Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Like, it has that whole Miami Vice feel to it.
That's clearly what they were going for they even made this.
And
just
then
to get this started, a martial arts Miami Vice.
Yeah, exactly. And then the ninjas show up and it gets weird.
Yes. Like, wait, what?
Though they use the gore budget very sparingly. I think they were being careful with it. But when they use it, they use it.
Yes.
One guy takes an axe to the head. He's got this big gory wound. I love that a shuriken to the neck killed a guy. The fight choreography is really worth the price of admission, I think.
And then you get some guys that they're not sure they're on camera in those fights, and they're kind of like posing with their fists up just in case they are, even though they're clearly dead center of the shot in the back. Oh, so there are things like that that really just, I was almost falling out of my chair laughing.
The fight scenes are brilliant. The rest is great unintentional comedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And with the white ninja costume, I think they thought it was a status thing because it was the leader who wears white.
Yes. You put that in quotes, leader, because at the end, it's a little confusing because they use a very obvious stunt double.
Oh, yeah. Because he's in a ninja costume. Like,
so they still have to fight the leader, right? And then they're like, oh no, that was supposed to have been the leader.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though you could see the beard underneath. I think it was really the other guy.
Brother.
I think it was the brother in the costume.
Who did the stunt, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the theme song is like some Adult Swim parody. It basically lays out the story of the movie.
Which is where I got the idea of Intrepidos Pugs, because all the music is just so on the nose.
At one point in the middle of the film, they do a song called Against the Ninja.
Right. It's one of the weirdest parts of the movie, because they're singing about something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And they wrote a song about something that will happen in the future, but has not happened yet at this time.
But we'd seen the ninjas. We knew they were the bad guys. It was a foregone conclusion at that point.
Of course. We as the audience saw the ninjas. They have yet to take on the ninjas.
And there's this conversation at the club. I think it's before they get to the... just before we hear the accursed song that you quoted in the intro. The song really does make me twitch.
Oh, man. The best.
Where they're talking about moving coke without any coating. Right outside this club, they're talking about moving cocaine directly. It's wouldn't they be, you know, calling it the stuff or the product? Or, I mean, I've never been in that business, but it just seems the obvious thing. If you're talking about illegal things, you coat it a little.
Yeah, you know, I knew someone that, you know, shirts and pants and stuff, you know,
right.
They're different things.
And they performed, and I can't remember the proper word, I apologize, but in their taekwondo uniforms.
Of course. Now, wait a minute, did I miss... I didn't want to go back and rewatch the scenes, but did I miss the guy getting fired for them to play?
No, that happened before the film.
Okay, because it's like this guy talking about this thing as if we'd seen it throughout most of the film. And I'm like, wait, what? Who is this guy? What is this? It's like Yosemite Sam sounding motherfucker.
And that's one of the subplots. The local band lost their gig at the club to Dragon Sound, and they go after Dragon Sound, and there's this big street fight. And then, of course, they team up with the drug running gang and the ninjas and blah, blah, blah. But one of the other hilariously bad parts, as a musician watching this, Angelo Donati, an actual guitar player, from what I understand, actually played at least the guitar and I would assume bass on the recordings.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the drums are programmed. I don't know who played the keys. But the guy who actually played them, he was good. He was fun to watch. But YK Kim's guitar miming was just hilarious. Vincent Hirsch, John, the bass player, was doing his best. I mean, I could tell he couldn't play, but he was at least trying. You know, the drummer and the keyboard player were trying. Like, if you're a musician, you can tell they're not doing it right.
Yeah.
But, you know, to a layman, they're it's passable. But YK Kim's guitar miming was just hilarious.
But I'm sorry. I could not pay attention to anything else but these lyrics.
Well, yeah. Of that song, I say, this is when the true horror of the movie becomes apparent.
It is, like, one of the greatest train wrecks I've ever seen. Because, I mean, it's... I had to go and Google the lyrics immediately, honestly, and have them all in my notes.
It's like a two-section thing, like a chorus and then another section after that, and that just repeats, right?
Yeah. Right, it's that was the chorus that we did at the beginning.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, it's almost like a Lonely Island song, too. You know, like for friends, you know, only they're being serious.
And musically, for 87, it's you know, standard pop.
Oh, yeah.
But, right. You know, and Against the Ninja, musically, at that age, honestly, I would have liked back in the day. Kind of a hard rock song. But the lyrics were just, you know... And
when
then,
I'm weak, you make me strong.
Please no.
I know I can depend on you to show the way and see me through.
If you've ever heard Clarence Clemens and Jackson Browne's You're a Friend of Mine, it's a similar horror.
We're on top because we play to win. We'll make our dreams come true.
Well, that last line, I won't get into the homoeroticism of, but...
There's nothing we can't do.
And then
it's kind of a payback for having us do all the house series,
okay,
I think.
There's that. And then after the club scene, we get to a scene in a computer science class. Now, classroom scenes can be interesting if there's a good debate to be had. Hell, Dead Poets Society was like half in a classroom.
Right.
You know, what's the one with Matt Damon? Good Will Hunting. You know, a classroom scene can be good, but I can't imagine a good scene in a computer science class. In a programming class, specifically.
But this is still better than, what's his name? Than the, using the college, the community college for classes.
Breen. But the whole point of this computer science class scene is so that Vincent Hirsch, John the bass player, can show up, mug for a few minutes to his girlfriend to try to get her out of the class. And then we get this annoying sob story from her that has no purpose. Except to maybe explain why her brother just became a thug.
I guess. I mean, right. It's all very weird. It's, oh, I don't like my brother. And then it's like, oh, my brother's coming to pick me up right now.
Yeah.
You know, just the dialogue is so unrealistic. Mm-hmm. It's no like, ah, oh, yeah, you know, my brother's kind of an asshole. You know, he's about to pick me up if you want to meet him, kind of thing. Instead of these separate sentences.
And then the brother shows up. Of course, he's pissed off at the bass player for dating his sister because he's got this unhealthy attachment to his sister. And he slugs the bass player. And the band rides up just after that. There's a whole standoff. Mark, YK Kim's character, manages to talk it down. But here we have the rather obvious, like, okay, this is why they're going to butt heads.
Right, I guess they couldn't do a fight scene on the in this college parking lot.
Right. Yeah. And whenever it cut to the ninjas, I was expecting it to turn into a decent martial arts movie. But then it cuts back to the band.
Right.
And then at the point, it seemed like, you know, the Coke ninjas were kind of a red herring.
Yeah.
Because we see the ninja leader at the club once or twice, but he's got glasses and his body language is completely different. It took me a while to realize that was him. He's just this Asian guy hanging out with the brother. Took me a while to realize, oh, that's the leader of the ninjas.
It's a very weird montage of them partying. You know, it's so Florida, too.
The Sturgis scene, yeah, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was just this biker rally in the middle of the movie. It made no sense.
No, it did not.
But the fight scene when the old band tracked down the new band, and they got like 40 people against 5.
Right.
And the band wins. Like this, the group of 5, you know, Dragon Sound, somehow wins. These 5 guys somehow take down like 8 to 10 each.
I mean, it's pure, you know, martial arts movie tradition. Yeah,
of course.
So, you know, and of course the point was they weren't exactly skilled fighters.
Right. And these guys were like surgical with their kicks.
What cracked me up though is John or Vincent Hirsch, mm-hmm. in 2 fight scenes, he runs away for some reason, gets chased all the way, you know, to some other part of the fight, like away from the main action, yeah. And then turns around and beats the shit out of everybody. why did he do that?
To avoid ads, you know. He drew a certain number of them off from the group so he didn't get, you know, more added to the fight, and then just took down the ones he was able to pull off. It was a good strategy.
I guess that makes sense, actually.
Yeah, it was a good strategy. It was too bad this wasn't a better movie, because I think it could have done a lot to popularize Taekwondo.
Come on. What more could they do? They had a song about, you know, Tai, Kai, Tai.
Yeah. But, yeah, Taekwondo was the art that didn't get a lot of play back in the day. You know,
really?
Karate and Kung Fu always did.
I remember hearing a lot about it. I mean, I guess not movie-wise.
Yeah, I mean, in the mainstream media. It didn't get a ton of play.
I felt I heard a lot about it, you know, like football players were like learning it to, you know, use it on the field and stuff.
But, you know, in the movies and TV, it didn't get as much play as, you know, of course, karate and kung fu did. And you know, it would have been nice if this was, you know, if this had been able to give it that boost.
They think they were just trying too hard to sell it here.
Yeah. It just wasn't enough else in the movie to sell it. Then we get to Jim, the keyboard player, getting the letter about his father.
Oh my God. Oh my God. At this point, I'm actually writing a note that they didn't, you know, lamenting that they did not write a script, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might want to consider writing a script. I start writing.
Uh-huh.
And then he gets into that little monologue of his, and I'm just like, oh my God, on second thought after hearing that, don't. Don't write any dialogue. Go back to the improvisation. That has to be one of the most awkward scenes.
Oh yeah, it's
I've
not just the
ever
writing.
Seen.
Maurice Smith, who played Jim, I think did an okay job with that emotional stuff. He was believable,
right? But it's what he was saying.
Yeah. But it starts off with, you know, of course, the band all live together. And John is playing keep away with this letter. He finally gets it out of his hand, opens it, mentions it's about his father. At this point, he says, you know, for some reason, he thinks he's not never going to meet his father. It was bad news. And it's this incredibly hilariously melodramatic scene that none of them have anywhere near the acting chops to pull off.
Right.
Except, like I said, Maurice Smith was believable, you know. But the rest of them are just kind of standing there staring at him. It looked like they were going to start singing doo-wop to back up his speech.
I was just, oh my God, I couldn't even look at the screen. I had to like look away. It was just that uncomfortable. The whole, like, my God, someone wrote this and then somebody else thought it was a good idea.
Cut from that incredibly melodramatic, uncomfortable scene to the most cliche 80s beach scene you can imagine.
Right.
Paired with the accursed song. Like, it was an 80s music video for, like, longer than a video should have been. And every just beach cliche from the 80s. And then right in the middle of the movie, we get a martial arts solo.
And yeah, this is obviously a scene that did not need to stay in, but because the whole point of this movie was to sell Taekwondo, they had to do a scene of them just practicing.
Well, it starts with like a couple of minutes of YK Kim just solo, just doing a kata. And then he brings in John and Jack, the drummer, and, you know, they start attacking him to show off different things. And I think he breaks a couple of boards or whatever. And it's basically an exhibition in the middle of the film. And then there's this incredibly awkward conversation between the three of them over lunch about how, you know, Jack doesn't want to play the club anymore because, you know, that band attacked them. And then, you know, they console him a bit. And then he hatches this plan where they're going to play all over the world in everybody's kind of, you know, nationality, home country. You know, John's Irish, they'll play in Ireland. Tom, the guitarist, is Italian, they'll play Italy. Jack's Jewish, they'll play Israel, blah, blah, blah.
I was expecting someone to turn to the camera and start just talking directly to the camera. In fact, YK Kim almost started doing that, really.
Uh-huh.
It's really an international thing, this Taekwondo.
Yeah. Thing is, I mean, they were a bit old for that conversation, but playing in high school bands, I had similar conversations.
You said, we'll play in all of these different locations and then visit Taekwondo.
Well, not the Taekwondo part. Not the Taekwondo part, but, you know, the playing in different, you know, countries. Yeah. I mean, that is a dream.
Like, almost made me fall out of my chair again, too. And they're like, and we'll visit Taekwondo centers after every gig.
I was
like, oh my God.
Yeah, they were definitely trying to push the Taekwondo, yeah. And at one point, Kim's Mark, like Kim says, in Korea, everybody practices Taekwondo.
Yeah.
I looked that up. Not exactly accurate. It's an exaggeration, but most men are trained in it, either, you know, in school or in the military. It's very popular over there. It's like the national sport and everything. So it wasn't nearly as much of an exposition or said exaggeration as I thought it would be. Then we have the fight at the diner. You know, a bunch of assholes, you know, try to do a dine and dash. The diner owner, who's kind of down on his luck, walks out and just cleans the floor with them as the band is rocking up. They want to help, but he's like, no, they're done already.
Right. That is one of the fakes of the movie. There are a few fakes that they get over where you expect them to come and rescue him, and instead, no, he just takes them all by himself.
There is a song that kicks in. It's just a little interstitial music right after that scene in the diner, because they go in and eat, of course, afterwards.
Yeah.
That sounds a lot like Take Me Home.
I don't remember.
I think it's mostly the drum pattern, but yeah, they kind of ripped a little bit of Take Me Home off for the score, because this was a couple years after No Jacket Required.
Yeah. It is the 80s.
But I honestly can't tell, like, which is worse, the acting or the music.
Ooh, it's a tough call. I mean, I don't know. I would say the music. The music is really just monumentally...
Well, I wasn't laughing at the music. I was just kind of shuddering at it. The bad acting was kind of amusing.
And, I mean, it's the power of the night. Like, yeah, only it's not funny.
It's ridiculously 80s. Funny. And cliche 80s. Thing is, the movie had a weird effect on me, because I watched it last night, and I mean, I had a good time with it. I enjoyed the action scenes. I got a good laugh out of the rest. Today, I kind of found myself developing more and more affection for it.
Oh, yeah?
Like, it just squeaked by a recommendation last night. Today, I think I might up my rating. Like, I kind of enjoy it more afterwards. After seeing it, it's kind of odd. But there's a, right after that random biker rally we were talking about, like the only nudity in the movie.
Yeah.
Is some random weird Sturgis scene. we get the scene where, you know, it's the middle of the night and the band is just kind of settling down. And Tom is writing a new song. And this is a thing that only musicians will get. They're a rock band. Tom is writing a new song on manuscript paper. Notes on manuscript without an instrument on hand noticeably. His guitar wasn't near. You didn't see a keyboard. He hands it to Mark. Mark glances at it for 2 seconds. That looks good.
Yeah.
Not only are they skilled martial artists, they're apparently ridiculously trained musicians who apparently play in a pop band for some reason.
Well, as one of the improv lines is, we're going to be the next Beatles.
But the Beatles probably couldn't even read music. I mean, they were moderately skilled pop musicians. They were not trained like that.
Why they're going to be the next Beatles, because they are even better. Come on.
I mean, these guys, in terms of training, would put Dream Theater to shame. But they're playing cheesy pop music. I don't get that. I mean, I get it. It was just, you know, nobody thought a musician would take a look at this and judge the scene, but.
Right.
And now Tom is kidnapped. I missed that scene entirely when it first happened.
Oh, really?
I was distracted by my notes, I guess. I was typing. I had to run it back. Wait, Tom was kidnapped? When did that happen? we never got the scene where they discovered Tom was kidnapped.
Right. We don't get any of that. It just they come for him.
Yeah, Tom is hauled away, and suddenly, you know, he's being tortured by the bad guys, and you know, the band has to come and rescue him. Got some great gore when they were, you know, sneaking in. I think somebody got their arm cut off, if I recall.
And what's the point of kidnapping somebody that when they come to break him out, mm-hmm. you don't say, "Hey, don't come any closer, or we're gonna do something to him."
Yeah,
you just, oh, they're here? Well, let's leave them there and we'll fight them. Mm-hmm. What's the point of kidnapping the guy?
Because approach one requires acting. Approach two just requires fighting. And this is when we finally get the return of the cocaine ninjas. I honestly thought they were just a dropped subplot.
is this the fight that gets broken up by the cops or no?
No, that was later, I think.
Okay.
This is the one where the leader of where the brother is killed.
Yeah.
This is the one where there's a standoff.
All right, on this one, the one at night, that other one was one at day.
Yeah,
right?
This is the one at night. There's a standoff on a ledge. Jeff, the brother who is, you know, running the gang, falls to his death. Next scene, one of the leaders of the cocaine ninjas, you know, walks into the dojo, tells the leader that his brother is dead. So Jeff, Jane's brother, a white guy, is the brother of the leader of the Asian leader of the cocaine ninjas. Maybe be metaphoric?
That's what I assumed, because, I mean, although I guess I now think of Orgasmo and the stunt cock and, like...
I mean, they established earlier that Jim is half Korean and half black, but neither the cocaine leader or cocaine ninja leader or Jeff looked, you know, mixed, so it was odd.
Right, and their parents were supposed to be dead.
Yeah, true.
None of that made any sense. Yeah.
And then we get the resolution of the father. Well, not the resolution of the father journey, but kind of the new wrinkle in it. Because, you know, Jim gets this piece of mail that tells him they found his father. A little continuity error there. He goes out to get the newspaper. No shirt. Nobody outside of, like, classroom, you know, campus scenes, nobody wears a shirt in this movie.
It's Florida.
Okay,
I didn't think anything of it, honestly.
Okay, apparently that's a Florida thing. But he pulls a newspaper and some letters out of the mailbox, puts it all on the shelf, on the door, basically, that's now a little, you know, shelf. Opens the letter, you know, starts screaming, oh my God, I'm going to meet my father. It cuts back to a wide shot. The newspaper's back in the mailbox. Just a nice little continuity error there. And of course, as soon as you find out, you know, he's going to meet his father, he's dead meat.
Right. Although you never can tell with this, because it's just, you know, well, what of course really happens in the end.
Do we want to spoil?
It is one of the funniest. It is one of the funniest damn lines in the movie, actually.
But okay. It's a happy ending. He survives. I'll say that much. But because there's not
Jim
much
was
of a
lucky.
Build
up. Yeah. The doctor comes out and says, "Jim was lucky," and wait, what?
But I had seen
almost
the alternate
internal organs spew out. Yeah. You know? Right. Like, oh, it's just a flesh wound,
and laid there for what, like an hour that way.
Something
while
like
they
that.
Were. Killing the rest of the ninjas. Well, John and Mark were killing the rest of the ninjas.
When I drove into the ninjas, all I kept thinking was the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
But I wish they had done like a, you know, instead of a Nazis, I hate Illinois Nazis, or ninjas, I hate Miami ninjas.
The original and now alternate ending is
what?
Where there ends with them rushing him to the hospital and he dies.
Wow.
That was the original ending. I had watched that before the movie. I couldn't remember if I had seen that separately as a clip or had kind of skimmed to the end of the movie, because I don't care about spoilers.
Yeah.
So I thought he died, and I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, how are they going to do this? I was actually really surprised when he lived. But, you know, there's, again, some nice gore as John and Mark are taking out the ninjas while, you know, Mark is, you know, laying there with his organs out.
You know, for ninjas, they do an awful lot of head-on fighting, don't they?
Yeah. I don't really think the fight choreographer, I'm going to say YK Kim in this case, probably, understood how ninjas work.
Right. It's about sneaking. It's about taking cheap shots.
Ninjas, by and large, were spies and mercenaries.
Right.
They were all about the stealth and the guerrilla warfare.
Exactly. They are not going to go for a head-on fight like in this movie they did 100 times.
Yeah, no. But again, some nice gore in that scene. Yes. Some of John's very kind of platoon-esque slow motion screaming with the sword shots were great.
Yeah.
He really acted the fuck out of those scenes. I loved it. And then one of the underlings runs up to the cocaine leader, ninja leader, tells him they're all dead. And without breathing practically, the leader pulls out his sword, decapitates him.
And then laughs.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Because there isn't a beat. It's just, they're all dead. Boom, off with his head. One more is dead. And then, Mark kills the cocaine ninja leader with a move that we saw during the solo.
Oh, right.
John was behind him with a knife, you know, miming like he was going to attack him, and they were showing all these takedowns. One of the takedowns involves turning the knife on your attacker and jabbing them in the stomach. He does this to the leader.
Foreshadowing in the solo.
Mm-hmm. And then once somehow they get Jim to the hospital on time, even though they spent like an hour killing ninjas while Jim's guts were falling out. He was lucky. Exactly.
Another one almost fell out of my goddamn chair.
Yeah.
So funny.
Sequels and remakes?
Oh, man. Never. They should never do a sequel or remake of this.
Well, they can't really do sequels. Yeah, I would say I wouldn't be surprised if it was remade, but nobody should. It's perfect as it is.
I mean, you have to have like Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. But I mean,
there was one dude that I thought was like Chris Farley from Beverly Hills Ninja, one of the like the heavy guy
with the beard. Yeah, he reminds me of like 20 different people.
There was a guy with like blonde hair and like almost a bowl cut though. Yeah. And I was like, is that Chris Farley?
The heavyset guy, one of the Coke yes. runners, the heavyset guy with the yes. beard. Yeah. He reminds me of like 20 people I've seen like either on YouTube or like in real life. He's got just one of those faces.
I was surprised though, one scene that got broken up by the cops. Cause it was like, this is Florida, you know,
mm-hmm.
were they breaking any laws in Florida? Like, who would even call the cops? They were, like, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, in a junkyard or something.
Right. Yeah, there was one fight. I think it was after... Yeah, it was after the gun runner... The brother, Jeff, was killed.
Yeah.
They lured them into this other fight to get revenge. Incidentally, when they went to rescue... or in the big fight at the end when Jim was almost killed, where the hell were the other two?
Well, you see, I think there were only 3 martial artists there. I think the other guys were actual, a couple musicians, and then you had, you know, Jack, who was an actor.
You think Jack was the actor? He was not an actor. He didn't think he would have to do it. He was upset when his role was expanded. I saw a little interview with him. Angelo Giannotti was a musician, but he was also a taekwondo student. He did some decent fighting. Jack did some decent fighting too. Joe Diamond. But they just weren't in that scene. Like they were in class or something. I just kind of figured they were in class.
You're probably right.
But yeah, it just seemed odd. So on to brains.
On to brains.
Like I said, I was originally it just squeaked by to get a recommendation, but the more I've talked about it, more I've thought about it and looked into it, it's perfect. Like, you don't touch this movie. It's amazing as is. It's a 5.
Yeah, I agree totally. This is up there with The Room. This is up there with Breed. This is an easy 5 because it is just, if you like bad movies, you will enjoy the fuck out of this because it's, I mean, the music's annoyingly bad, but that just adds to it.
It's a hilariously bad movie with really good fight scenes.
Yes, that too. The fight scenes are actually good. That's very, very strange. You're kind of like, wait, what are we watching here? I mean, it's the same movie, though, where he goes to, like, tell a woman that he's killed her brother. And Then they start making out, like, right. shortly thereafter.
Right. So what have we learned?
Laugh all you want, but I bet David Lee Roth worked breaking bricks and wood into his act, too.
Oh, I'm sure. And I learned that ninjas only care about money. I have
all
a second.
All about the money.
Yeah. I have a second. What have I learned that you kind of turned me against there for a second? I'm talking about it's a Florida thing, but I love how I worded this. Being a martial arts rock star means never having to wear a shirt.
Oh, I also have another thing that I learned too. In Florida, more people have swords than guns.
Actually, from what I've heard about Florida, that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I didn't learn that from this. Actually, yeah. I kind of knew that.
It's yeah.
But only one person actually had a gun in this movie.
Right, right. You've heard, you know, there's that gag, you know, I studied the blade.
But a shit ton of people had swords, that's for sure.
You know, it's that meme, you know, while you were doing whatever, I studied the blade. Florida is the embodiment of that meme.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it for Miami Connection. Until next time, we'll be reviewing Star Crash. This is our Christopher Plummer tribute. Yes, Christopher Plummer did a lot of amazing movies. He was a brilliant actor. But he only did, far as I know, one that's in our wheelhouse. So that's going to be the tribute. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.